This week on Making Contact.
Why they thought my 65-year-old father was doing a drive-by shooting with a woman and four kids in the car, I don't know. I only know that he was the first black man that they ran into that night.
We just believe that it's really time for us to stand up with our immigrant brothers and to proclaim that the racial profiling is unjustified.
Since September 11th, racial profiling has been used as a tactic in what government officials call the war on terrorism. But for African Americans in the United States, racial profiling is nothing new. On this program, we speak to African American organizers, police officers, and religious leaders who are working to put a stop to this practice in their communities. We also take a look at another form of racial profiling, retail discrimination. I'm Stephanie Welch, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In a recent address to the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, President Bush said,
"Racial profiling, it's wrong in America, and we've got to get rid of it."
Eager politicians and police chiefs across the country have echoed this sentiment. But many African Americans say that while racial profiling as a policy is being condemned in newspapers and speeches, it's still a common police practice on the streets and in their neighborhoods. Making Contact's Damian Irizarry has more.
For years, stories of black and Latino drivers being searched on the basis of skin color alone were dismissed as anecdotal. But as horrifying images of police misconduct began to disseminate on nightly newscasts and in courtrooms, what had been common knowledge in communities of color now began to raise suspicions in other segments of society. Attitudes began to shift as the terms racial profiling and driving while black entered the American vocabulary. Today, according to a Gallup poll, 70% of Americans believe racial profiling happens, and it shouldn't. Yet many African Americans believe that little has changed. To understand how deeply ingrained racial profiling is both culturally and psychologically in American society, and why progress on this issue is slow-moving, David Harris, a law professor who authored Driving While Black, a study published by the ACLU, says we must first look at its history.
In the South, and even in some places in the North, police departments often had their origin, and if not their origin, then a significant relationship to slave patrols and patrols designed to pick up fugitive slaves in the North. We fast forward then to about the mid-80s and the drug war. The DEA was using profiles of couriers on airplanes who were moving drugs from city to city by taking domestic flights. And they decided that they thought it would be a good idea to use this profiling technique on the public roads and highways.
A technique that had proven, by the Drug Enforcement Agency's standards, to be successful in America's airports.
It was a federal program called Operation Pipeline. And the DEA set up Operation Pipeline to teach profiling techniques and tactics to police officers in state, county, and municipal police departments around the nation so that then they could go back and train people within their own departments. The DEA trained, by differing accounts, anywhere between 25 and 45,000 officers in these profiling tactics.
Meanwhile, in the courts, proving cases of racial profiling has been daunting. In the last 15 years, says Harris, the courts, especially the Supreme Court, have all but made racial profiling legal. A big blow to racial profiling lawsuits came in 1996, when the U.S. Supreme Court declined to limit police ability to use race as a factor in making traffic stops. Where history and the courts have not provided an answer, African American activists have responded with community pressure, new legislation, and work within the police department. Diop Kamau is the executive director of the Police Complaint Center and a former police sergeant from Hawthorne, California. Diop founded the Complaint Center after several incidents he observed as a police officer that he didn't agree with. One such incident involved his father, who was pulled over by the Pomona, California Police Department late one night.
They said that my 65-year-old father matched the description of a 25-year-old robbery suspect.
He was pulled out of his car at gunpoint with my sister and four toddlers in the car and severely beaten. And ultimately he was released. They dusted him off and said, well, we guess you're not the guy. Now, why they thought my 65-year-old father was doing a drive-by shooting with a woman and four kids in the car, I don't know. I only know that he was the first black man that they ran into that night.
After this, Diop spent his weekends armed with hidden video cameras and set out to document instances of racial profiling and police misconduct. During one of his investigations in Long Beach, California, he was pulled over by the local police himself.
Claiming that our vehicle is weaving all over the highway, in their police report they claimed that I jumped out of the vehicle in a karate stance and tried to take the officer's baton. What they didn't know is that the entire incident was being recorded and that I didn't do anything more than ask him why I was being stopped. At that point, he asked me to turn around. I put my hands behind my head, and the officer slammed my face through a plate glass window.
Diop resigned from his job as a sergeant and now works with a number of ACLU chapters and cop watch groups around the country and provides training for hidden camera testing of police departments and their practices. Diop says that documenting police abuse is important when trying to prove racial profiling.
The average person that this happens to is unlikely to have the resources to convince anyone that they were victimized. So those community-based organizations that are interested in attacking the problem need to develop techniques and strategies that would allow them to document what people in the community are claiming.
Sergeant DeLacy Davis is a 14-year veteran of the East Orange, New Jersey Police Department. His organization, Black Cops Against Police Brutality, or BCAP, is an organization that works to eliminate racial profiling and police misconduct from within the police department. He founded BCAP after a curious training manual landed on his desk, detailing what to look for when making traffic stops.
The manual articulated that Jamaicans and Haitians actually, it says that they were transporting narcotics, that they were handling marijuana, what to look for in the vehicle's bumper stickers, the black, red, and green flag, the Ethiopian flag, Haitian flags, those kinds of things, and that you would then manufacture probable cause, accept nothing at face value, interview the driver and the passenger to get to your probable cause.
DeLacy took this manual and confronted the distributor. He was met with assurances that a new edition was being printed and such racial biases would be absent. It's been 3 years, and DeLacy is still waiting to see the new manual. BCAP also educates community members to minimize conflict with officers.
Don't get engaged in long and extended and protracted discussion with the police. They're not there to be friendly with you per se. And so if you determine that it's not a good stop, your conversation should go no more than yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. There's nothing to get involved with. If they tell you you're under arrest, shut up. Give them your name, your address, your attorney, a phone number, and call it a day. Confronting them in conversational tone certainly doesn't help. If you look at the manual, it creates an opportunity for them to find probable cause to arrest you. So if you're going to be arrested anyway, stop talking to the police and shut it all down.
Recently, DeLacy partnered with Reverend Al Sharpton to shut down the New Jersey Turnpike to raise awareness of racial profiling and police brutality. Working from the inside has not come without its costs. DeLacy has had his house burned down, his life threatened, and car destroyed. Meanwhile, in Cincinnati, Reverend Canon Nan Pete of the Episcopal Diocese says that the church can also be a powerful instrument of pressure.
Our church has called together the urban clergy to talk about how our churches can respond and be instruments of healing and reconciliation. You know, having conversations, dialogue, reaching out to the community.
Hillary Shelton is the director of the NAACP Washington Bureau, which is the federal legislative and national public policy division. He says that in addition to education and community organizing, bills need to be passed. Currently, he is working on a bill that calls for police departments to compile records of all traffic stops. It would also make the practice of racial profiling illegal and would allow individual citizens to sue non-compliant police departments. In addition, the bill would establish education programs for police officers.
We've worked very closely with our friends on the House and the Senate side to introduce comprehensive legislation that we believe will help affect this issue to help prevent racial profiling from continuing. Our good friends, Congressman John Conyers from Detroit, and our good friend, Senator Russ Feingold, Hillary Clinton, and John Corzine introduced legislation in the House and Senate to address this issue. This bill is called the End Racial Profiling Act of 2001.
Sam Anderson, a leader of the Black Radical Congress, says African Americans and people of color have accepted racial profiling as normal.
Our duty is to make it abnormal and to destroy it. The way we have to do that is by organizing, not just on the legal front, not just on the electoral political front, but in the community, and particularly among our young people, to understand that this stuff is not going to go away until we fight it away. It's not going to go away by prayer. It's not going to go away by legal suasion. It goes by us being organized in a fighting opposition to this, in all senses of the word, fight.
For Making Contact, I'm Damian Irisari.
Since the September 11th attacks, Muslims have been targets of ethnic profiling in the United States. Making Contact correspondent Jamil Kubeka spoke with Amir Abdul Malik, an African-American Muslim leader in Oakland, California. Amir Abdul Malik says that African-American Muslims should draw upon the historic struggle with racism in the United States to assist Arab Muslims in this current crisis.
For the African-American, racial profiling is no new thing. It's something that's been going on. It's still going on, very blatant, whether it has to do with dealing with the police or whether it has to deal with on a somewhat smaller level, if you will. You're in a store and you're being followed around the whole store by the employees there simply because of your color. So it hasn't abated. What has happened since September 11th is that new victims have been added to the list of racial profiling. So now we have African Americans who are continuously going through racial profiling, and now who's added are our Arab Muslim brothers. Our position is, we believe, the Islamic position, that although the events of September 11th is impacting more on the immigrant Muslim population, we have an obligation to stand with them and to help them because of the fact that we know America, we know Sam. Matter of fact, no one knows Sam like we do. So we just believe that it's really time for us to stand up with our immigrant brothers and to proclaim that the racial profiling is unjustified.
African Americans have been dealing with this problem for a long time, as you have mentioned as well. Have you been approached by Muslims of Arab ancestry for advice in ways to resist the profiling?
Yes. We've reached out to our immigrant brothers, and they reached out to us. One of the things we talk about is history. We have to talk about history. We share that with them. It's very, very important for them to understand the history. The civil rights movement, for example, like every Sunday, for example, we during our Talim, we've been going over Eyes on the Prize to try to refamiliarize the Muslims who come, most of whom are indigenous Muslims, but to try to familiarize them with the history, because we're going back into that period again. So we try to share that history with them. We also try to share with them recent history. Who got blamed for the bombing in the Olympics? Us. Without any evidence. Who got blamed for a flight TWA 800 that went down? Us. Ted Koppel does a story with these mysterious letters in Arabic that they found in London suggesting that Muslims did it. And we were blamed for that. Then it came out that it was mechanical failure. We remind them of all those things in this country and outside this country. That view is the mainstream view. The view that I just gave is the mainstream. And those Muslims, unfortunately, who have become so frightened and so afraid and so intimidated and who are trying to apologize for things that we did not do, that's not the mainstream view. They're making it appear that that's the mainstream view. That's not the mainstream view. In America particularly, there's like a silent majority, if you will. Muslims and immigrant brothers are reluctant to speak out because of the anti-terrorism bill, the first one. Anti-terrorism bill of 1996. One of the things it says that if you send money back home and if the State Department determines that your money is going to a terrorist organization, you spend 10 years in prison. That's the anti-terrorism bill of 1996, that if somebody comes into the masjid and listens to somebody's talk and they have a suspicion that this person is tied into terrorists, they're detained, they're arrested based on secret evidence, right? So they're reluctant to speak out, but we're not reluctant to speak out. You know what I'm saying? Like I said, we're used to this. And so those are the type of some of the things that we share with the Muslims and we share with the non-Muslims.
Amir Abdul-Malik, speaking with correspondent Jamil Kubeka. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information on the subject of this week's program, or if you'd like to get in touch with our guests, go to our website, www.radioproject.org, or you can call our toll-free number, 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736, for comments and suggestions for future programs. It's informally referred to as shopping while black. Victims say they're followed around department stores by security guards, are refused service at restaurants, and are asked for multiple forms of identification upon purchase. Some say that for African Americans and people of color, retail discrimination is part of the routine shopping experience. But civil rights organizations, legal advocates, and many victims say community discussions need to take place in order to find ways to end this illegal and humiliating practice. Making Contact, Shireen Marisol Meraji reports.
In January 2002, a forum was held in downtown San Francisco to illuminate the concerns of victims of racial profiling in retail stores. The forum, simply titled Overcoming Retail Discrimination, was sponsored by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area, along with other community organizations and business representatives. Before the forum began, hugs and words of encouragement were exchanged among victims of racial discrimination who had been invited to share their stories, and the attorneys and advocates for civil rights who were also panelists. Elaine Vaughn, a university professor and expert on bioterrorism, was the first to share her experience. Slightly nervous, she told the group of nearly 50 men and women from all walks of life what happened to her at a Macy's department store in Orange County.
I went to do some professional attire shopping, and my son had insisted on superhero pajamas for his birthday. Mm-hmm. So I arrived in a cab, as I usually do. A few minutes before the store opened, nothing unusual happened. I waited until the store opened and proceeded to the children's department. I noticed that Macy's employees, one in particular, was in a little bit closer proximity than usual. And I thought, well, Macy's sometimes are helpful, but not really. She didn't really ask me for assistance. I proceeded to go, after a few minutes shopping, to the counter, and the salesperson became visibly nervous, and I couldn't understand what was up with that. I had an armful of clothes, but I asked her for the superhero pajamas. I had forgotten to get those, and immediately she said, "We don't carry those." Another older woman, another sales associate, said, "Of course we do," and she looked very puzzled. So I went to do that. I returned to the counter and presented my corporate Visa card to pay for the purchases. This person, I will try and make this brief, but for an extended time, began to look at the credit card over and over and over again. It was a signed credit card. Finally, she submitted it. The charges were approved, but she wouldn't complete the sale.
Vaughn said she was then asked for her ID, which had never been requested from her at a Macy's.
So I asked her, what was the problem? Was there a problem? Well, Macy's always requires photo ID whenever you use a credit card. And so she took the photo ID I presented and kept looking and looking and still wouldn't complete the sale. This went on and on. She finally completed the sale. I went to the other department, but I was quite devastated because it was very humiliating. It was obviously something was wrong. And as I walked away, I noticed I had been watched very carefully. As it turns out, I subsequently found out that I had been videotaped the entire time I was in the store. I had been watched outside of the store and targeted as a suspected. The story has changed, but at first a suspected shoplifter and now credit card fraud.
Randy Wah, a father of two living in Oakland, California, came face to face with blatant racial discrimination when trying to get a refund from a U-Haul manager who overcharged him for renting a truck. Wah reenacted the encounter.
You know, I identified myself and I said, "You just spoke with my wife on the phone. And you were very rude to her, and we want a refund. We have our receipts proving that you guys overcharged us." He continued to deny the whole conversation that he had on the phone with her. So I told them that, well, we've got a problem. We want our money back. We got our receipts and everything. So he said, no, I got a better idea. So he storms inside the establishment, and he calls the police, and he tells them that the store's being robbed.
Wah went to the U-Haul office with his wife and two small children. He says that he couldn't believe what happened after the manager called the police.
The police came, and there were about 10 other people in the store. We were the only African-American couple in there. They ordered everybody out of the establishment, and everybody put your hands on your head. As soon as I walked out the door, he told me, here, stand over here. He didn't even ask me who I was, didn't know me from nothing, never met me, didn't talk to the manager, didn't know anything, and told me, here, stand over here. And he began to pat me down and put me in handcuffs. So I stood out there for about 15, 20 minutes in handcuffs while he interrogated me about the whole situation. By this time, my 2-year-old and my 8-month-old, they're looking at me like, you know, what's going on, and they're asking questions and everything. And after that had happened, before we left the establishment, the officer that was in charge, he approached me and he said, just for the record, do you have any weapons in your car? And I told him, I'm down here with my family, you know. To even ask me something like that is ludicrous. I'm walking in here with two babies in a stroller and my wife. So after that incident happened, we called U-Haul corporate office and spoke to a guy, Gary, there. And he said that he would look into it and he would get back to us. And, of course, he never called, never heard nothing from him. So that's why we proceeded to take legal action against him.
Michael Harris is the assistant director for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area. He says that the committee decided to do a public education campaign on retail discrimination in response to a flood of phone calls received from victims. Harris says that if you've been discriminated against in a retail outfit in California and the company ignores your complaints, you can do something about it.
In California, there are, throughout the state, offices of the state agency called the Department of Fair Employment and Housing that will take your complaint, investigate, and will sue on your behalf if the investigation shows that discrimination actually took place.
There are also federal laws which provide some protections for individuals who have suffered racial discrimination. But Harris says that those laws are outdated and don't always help victims of retail discrimination.
42 U.S.C. 1981, which is a Civil War era Civil Rights Act. It was enacted right after the Civil War, and it basically said African Americans shall have the same rights to enter into contracts, enter and enforce contracts as whites. I mean, that was the paradigm at that point in time, and so that's how it was written. And so the language there, because it uses the word contract, many judges who are very conservative and pro-business and have adopted these same stereotypical ideas about people of color and women, they construe that language very narrowly. And so basically what they say is, if you buy the shoes or the blouse or the hat, even though they search you and detain you and do all these things to you that they don't do anyone else, and so they've clearly been subjected to discrimination, you got everything you're entitled to because you completed the contract, because the sale was completed.
Harris says part of the Lawyers Committee campaign includes working to revise federal civil rights laws so they will protect people across the country from the type of discrimination that Rondi Wah and Elaine Vaughn suffered. For Making Contact, I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji.
Another speaker at the Overcoming Retail Discrimination Forum talked about being proactive immediately after any discrimination occurs. Rosalind Taylor O'Neill directs the corporate training program at Barnes O'Neill & Associates in San Jose, California. She's an advisor on issues of diversity and discrimination to businesses worldwide. O'Neill gave some practical advice to people who may encounter racial profiling when shopping.
Remain calm. You know, you're in that store. You know, you've been waiting in line. Somebody who's not like you walks up and they get served. And you just think, I'm going to go ballistic. Rage is anger plus history. It's anger, somebody stepped in front of me, plus history.
last week, week before last year, year before last, 2 years before that. First of all, I assume that the person who had that happen, I'm going to go with the assumption they made a mistake. I'm not going to talk about why they made the mistake. I'm going to make the assumption they made a mistake. And I need to point out to them that they made a mistake. In the same way that is if they gave me back too much change or too little change, I don't necessarily go to the reason they gave me too much change. We'll use that one. Because, you know, you give them a $5 bill and, you know, they give you back four and they should have only given you back three. You don't say, I bet it's racist. They gave me an extra dollar because I'm a black person. I know it's racist. I say to them, oh, I'm sorry, you must have made a mistake because I was here before she was. Then they say, oh, I didn't see you. I say to them, oh, I find that hard to believe. Do you see me now? So I say to them, no, I'm guessing that's not true. And then people are flustered. So I say to them, I just want you just made a mistake. Now what I'd like to do is I'd like to talk to your manager. You and I just walk out and grumble and tell folks who can't do anything about it. Okay, so I come out, I go back to work and I tell him, I can't believe it. I do it, Macy. They treated me badly. Well, what's he going to do? But except tell me, well, yeah, you know, they did the same thing to me. And then we're just both mad. So I say to him, as a store that I know wants to attract people, I'd like to help you to understand that sometimes your people make mistakes and you need to help figure out how do you train them so they don't make those mistakes. So I tell the store manager. I tell that person's manager. I tell the store manager. I call corporate. I send corporate a letter. Speak up. Tell somebody. Send a letter. Make a call. Take the extra 5 minutes, folks. It will save the next person from going through the same crap you're going through. It will save your grandchild from going through the same crap you're going through. It'll save your neighbor. It will save that person who is in a wheelchair, who's different from you, but who faces the same kinds of stuff. Report the incidences to the Better Business Bureau. Send an email and copy everybody and the grandmother. This is how I was treated, and I am telling you, people will respond to you. When they see that the email went to the NAACP, for those of us who are African Americans, the Urban League, the Chamber of Commerce, the Better Business Bureau, and their corporate folks, you can bet you're going to get a call from them. It's very easy to find out who the CEO of a corporation is. Send a letter to the CEO. I just think you ought to know about this. You spend $1 billion a year trying to attract African Americans, and by the way, there are now 200 of us who are not going to shop at your store. And we're going to tell 7 people, and they're going to tell 7 people, so you do the math.
Rosalind Taylor O'Neill, speaking at the Overcoming Retail Discrimination Forum in San Francisco, California. That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at racial profiling. Thanks for listening. Philip Babbage is our managing producer, Laura Levati, managing director, Peggy Law, executive director, co-producer Shireen Meraji, Administrative Coordinator Rosalind Fay, Women's Desk Director Lisa Redman, Senior Advisor Norman Solomon, National Producer David Barsamian, and I'm your host and co-producer Stephanie Welch. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you'd like to reach any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. You can also go to our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.